This is Mental Selling. This is the sales podcast for people that are dedicated to making a difference in customers' lives and have a purpose beyond just a paycheck. I'm your host, Will Milano. Let's get right into the show. Conversations are the lifeblood of sales. Conversations with customers, with our managers, with peers, and with ourselves. What you know is important, but how you communicate it is even more important. The ability to develop strong business relationships hinges on our ability to communicate. And developing that ability takes work and takes confidence. Welcome back to Mental Selling, your favorite sales podcast. To talk about these things today, I'm joined by Dr. Wanda Wallace, managing partner of Leadership Forum. Wanda helps leaders and teams improve the quality of their conversations, conversations that result in better relationships, which lead to better performance. She's also the author of the book, You Can't Know It All, Leading in the Age of Deep Expertise, and host of the radio show and podcast, Out of the Comfort Zone. Wanda, thank you so much for taking time to be with me today.
It's a pleasure, Will. I love this selling topic, even though I must admit, I never think of myself as a salesperson. But truthfully, we're all salespeople somehow at the end of the day.
We're going to begin today with why our ability to communicate is so essential and also about how we can improve not just our communication skills, but our confidence in how we communicate, because the confidence factor matters and will come across, doesn't it?
Most communication specialists say that 80% of the message is conveyed by something other than the words that you say. That means getting all the rest of the stuff right, plus the words that you say, is really incredible. And if I think about us as human beings, we're constantly making almost, it's not unconscious, it's subconscious decisions. Whether I like you, whether I trust you, whether I believe what you're saying, whether I want to talk to you further, whether I just want you to go away, we're making all those calculations. In effect, are you a friend or an enemy, if you want to think about evolutionary terms. If you think about somebody choosing to buy from you and they don't like you, good luck. It's just that simple. This in the conversation carries everything about whether they're going to want to talk further or not talk further.
Yeah, that idea of it goes way beyond, and it's how you get those messages across.
Now, you mentioned confidence. You want to talk about confidence for a moment?
I know part of what you do is help people be more reflective about ways to improve their communication skills and address their weaknesses, things like that.
You want people to lean into their strengths for sure, but you also want to bring some of those weaknesses up a bit because they're going to just elevate your strengths. The biggest mistake I watch people make in communications are two, and I want to highlight those first, and then I'm going to talk about confidence because the two boost your confidence. Number one, most of us have not thought nearly enough about what we want to say. So the acid test at the end of the day is if you had a 30-minute presentation that you were going to run through or a whole series of pitches you were going to give to a client, could you do it in less than a minute? And if you don't know what your core message is in less than a minute, then you're not going to be effective in communication. And when you know that core message that clearly, then it's easier to have confidence because you know what you really want to get to. You're not sitting there trying to memorize every single point you were trying to say and think about it and carry it. You can't tune into the person. So that knowing what you want to say is really essential and is easier said than done. We find it takes an outside person to help you refine it, that it takes months, not days, to refine that message. And so on we go. The second mistake that we make in conversations is we try to tell and we don't ask. The secret is in asking questions that get somebody else to talk. And we're so nervous about that because I got to get my point across. Actually, you don't. What you've got to do is let me leave the other person feeling heard. That's where the relationship is built. And by the way, having the questions is a whole lot easier on your confidence than remembering everything you wanted to say. So those are the two starting points. Then we can go to how do you build your confidence?
A lot of what you're talking about is the preparation aspect, especially in sales when you're dealing with customers and that idea that you can't be cookie cutter about, oh, I've done this presentation 712 times, but you've got to do that preparation in the context of that individual that you're speaking with, prepare questions that are relevant and compelling for that individual.
I was just recently in a conversation with a very senior financial services person whom I adore a lot. He's really good. And he was describing an interaction with a potential client, the work that he had gone through to be prepared to have this interaction. Yes, he's got a bunch of junior people coming with him and doing the preparation deck. They're proposing a particular solution for this client. And you know, he'd gone to rehearsals. He was deeply involved and had invested enormous amounts in the relationship in advance that gets them to the table. But he says, when I got there, he didn't let them open the sales book. No part of it was going to open. He started with questions. And so they had a conversation. And at one point, there was a question about a detail. And they could turn to page 29 and say, here's the answer to the detail, which shows that they've done their homework. But it also means that they were confident enough to put their message aside and just listen. That is the secret sauce combination. And it's a weird one. I have to know what I'm talking about deeply, and then I have to put it aside and listen.
And that idea of being able to say less is much harder. And like you said, boiling down a 30-minute presentation to what's the essential message in 1 minute, that's a lot more difficult than you might think. As you said, it's going to require that preparation up front. I think a big theme of this discussion around communication is a lot of people, especially people in sales, they misinterpret the idea of communication, as you were saying earlier, telling. Versus the most important part, especially up front, is that asking questions and listening portion.
All right, so let me put this in one more way from one more story from one of my clients. So if you think about what we want to do is prove to the client that we're super smart. I know your business better than you do. I know what you need better than you know what you need. And when you put it in that stark of a light, it's a little offensive to a customer. I've lived this business how long? And you think you're going to come in and know more than I know about it? And if it were me, I would chuck you right out the door. Quit wasting my time. You don't need to prove your value. You need to prove your ability to relate and connect to the customer and the customer's needs. And now you still have to know what you're talking about, or you and your team have to know what you're talking about. You can't be BSing.
One of the things we've talked on this show about before that I wanted to get your perspective on is the idea of sales as a team sport, not solo, because I know you've got some perspectives around that.
Maybe there are some sales efforts that are solo efforts in a commodity space, maybe. But even that isn't solo because somebody somewhere is producing whatever you're selling. Somebody somewhere is pricing whatever you're selling. Somebody somewhere has other connections into the customer that you're selling into, especially if it's a large organization. The touch points of things that bring you to a customer to be able to sell to that customer are many, but we don't think about it. We think just about me and that particular customer, and it's all on me and I'm all by myself. The companies that I watch that are winning today, particularly in complex sales, are thinking about this as hunting as a pack. So they're thinking about how do we blanket this organization? How many touch points do we have in this organization? So even when my particular customer says, yes, I want to talk to Wanda, absolutely. But they've gotten there because one of Wanda's teams has a connection with one of their friends, or I've done something for somebody else in the organization, or somebody else has brought a service to someone. We've just touched many points. And what that does is raise the client's comfort that human, a good person, worth talking to, and probably worth buying from. The companies that I'm watching really win at this are very methodical in how they think about the myriad of relationships they're involved.
And it creates more confidence from the customer's standpoint. If you sort of bring a greater depth and breadth of expertise, resources, et cetera, to the table versus the solo act, it's going to create a natural stickiness and greater affinity with that customer, don't you?
Well, and if you can say to the customer, look, I'm not the one who knows all the details about that particular thing, but if you want to know it, I can't tap somebody who does. And just that component increases the connectivity between you and the customer and the chances that they talk to you again. You know, all of that is powerful. Now, if I go back to my senior financial services person that I mentioned at the very beginning, trying to sell to this new client, part of that effort was to say, how many touch points can I and the team build within this organization? And not all at the senior level. It's getting that junior team to find their counterparts and make a connection point with our counterparts. That's what's going to make it run smoothly all the way through.
A lot of those junior members become your strongest advocates and champions. And they're also the senior leaders of tomorrow, right?
Get to know them now. And then as they rise in the hierarchy, there's your relationship developing over time. And I will tell you, one of my best sales strategies is contrary to a lot of my competitors who want to sell to the top of the house. I recognize that, yes, I'm selling to the top of the house, but my gatekeeper is HR. And if I don't make that gatekeeper happy, I will not have repeat sales.
It's such a fundamental error that a lot of salespeople make, which is just on the surface, they will be dismissive of the more junior level stakeholders that actually carry a lot more weight than you think.
My sales strategy, give it away, is I work with junior HR people who are often assigned an admin role in something that I'm doing. I make sure they look good. I coach them a little bit to be better in their job. Eventually, they move on to another company and bring me with them. Single best sales strategy I've ever found.
Right. That's the lifeblood of a lot of salespeople is those customers that come back to you, that bring you with them to that next role, that next company, that promotion.
Will, I want to go back to the confidence. When you recognize I know what I want to say, I got my core message. When you know that you've got your questions, that you're going in to listen, not to have the answer. When you know that you've got a team supporting you around you, and you know that you have built an emotional, personal connection, the confidence game is a completely different one. It's not me standing up in front of a strained audience saying, let me pump myself up and be ready to go. And it's just straightforward. From there, you want to make sure that you are not giving away a lack of confidence in your body language. So things like posture, fidgeting, all of those things you can pick up and read in any body language guide anywhere. Eye contact, friendly, smiling, all those usual things that, again, I think most salespeople have read or can read somewhere. But that's your outward show. The hardest part of confidence is your mental game. But your mental game is sharp when you do all the things that we just talked about.
From your perspective, what else is there that accelerates trust in the context of both working with customers and if you're in a sales leadership role, working with your teams, that idea of cementing and accelerating trust? What are any other ways that that happens?
In the next 3 years, we're going to decide that trust is the secret sauce for absolutely everything that organizations want to do. If you think about it, if I trust you, I'm going to listen to what you say differently than if I don't trust you. Your ability to influence is dramatically different when there's trust than when there's not. You're not going to get there when there's no trust. And everybody is focused on trust as being reliable and being credible, meaning reliable as I do what I said I was going to do and credible as I know what I'm talking about. Those are table stakes. If you don't have those, get out of the business, find something else, move on. It isn't, or go build them. That isn't what builds trust. What builds trust is the personal relationship, and that is built on personal connection. Fundamentally, what do we have in common? Where is our human-to-human connection, not our business-to-business connection? And a lot of that is, can I put you in your comfort zone when I'm trying to talk to you?
The credibility aspect, like you said, is table stakes. And I think sometimes salespeople make that mistake of trying to build their credibility in the room when the fact is they wouldn't be in the room in the first place. That's part of the business development, brand building, et cetera, process at the beginning that gets you in the door.
Especially with somebody who's about to spend money with you, especially on a complex product, they're not wasting their time, I promise you, more than 30 seconds.
I've also heard you say that customer complaints can be a gift. Why is that? Is it more about just how you respond to those complaints, or what's your perspective there?
So there's a complaint that says what you did cost me bajillions of dollars. Those you may never recover from. But a customer who complains about an onboarding process or a customer who complains about a quality of something that you produced is a chance to show the customer that you care. And how you respond is everything. Your entire credibility is on the line at that moment, and the relationship is on the line. So if you think about it, if it were your best friend that had a complaint about what you sold them, what would you do? You would say, I'm sorry, in an appropriate way. You do everything imaginable to fix the problem, and on we'd go. Or you're going to lose the friendship. It's the same thing when you recognize that sales is a relationship game. So you want to maintain that trust. Trust is built on the personal connection. This is your chance to show how much the impersonal connection is to you. So you've got to handle it really smartly. And I have seen, this is old data, but I've seen experiments where service, for example, was less than expected. The company responds to correct the service in some way and to apologize appropriately. And if they do that, then this customer satisfaction actually is higher than if there was never a problem to begin with. But the old adage of, I'm sorry you have this problem, 1990 was probably a good thing to say. Today, I just want to hit somebody when they say, I'm sorry you have this problem. You're not sounding sorry at all. I want to know, what are you going to do about it?
That I'm sorry you have this problem doesn't convey I'm taking ownership of the situation.
It doesn't convey any empathy for what that problem is costing me. That's what I want, is empathy. And often you don't even have to fix it. I just want you to recognize, yes, and I will report this. Or yes, we're going to do 1, 2, 3, just some action.
But I think that's a great perspective, this idea that don't fear possible customer complaints, because like you said, at the end of the day, you address them properly and your customer satisfaction, engagement, and loyalty probably be much higher than it would have been otherwise.
Now, I'll say if you have a consistent same problem, please will you take that internally and try to get that problem fixed, not just by your statements to your customers.
How do you navigate difficult conversations better? And that can be, again, both with customers or maybe it's with your manager.
This is a 3-day workshop to get through all of this. All right. So I'm going to cut through it in a sort of bite-sized chunks. So hang with me. First is, it takes, if you're going to deal with a difficult conversation, you have got to do a bunch of prep. Let me start at the beginning. It is always emotional. Anybody who tells you it's not emotional is giving you really bad advice. You can't take the emotion out of it. It matters to you and it matters to your counterpart. So accept that the emotions are there and don't try to belittle them. Now, I'd like you to try to manage them. I don't want you to shout and scream or kick the trash can or something, but emotions are part of it. Then that means you have a lot of prep to do. And this is the part people don't do nearly enough time on. Because your prep is what's going to allow you to do the next steps that make a difference. And I have two things I always focus people on doing. One is, if I have a problem with you, let's say, and I want to talk about this in a difficult conversation, then I have a conclusion about you, a judgment about you. And you can dress that up any way you want to dress it up, but it's still a conclusion and a judgment. Let's say I've decided you don't like me. It's going to be hard to sell to you because you don't like me. And I want to talk to you about why you don't like me. That's a judgment. And if I say that, I promise you it will go badly wrong. So I need to acknowledge the judgment on my own privately. And then I want to back away from that judgment and speculate what else might be going on. So I might say, yes, well, you may not like me, but yes, you may be really frustrated by the job. Yes, you may be overburdened by time. Yes, you may have somebody else in the organization who doesn't like me. I could list a dozen reasons. Most of us get stuck on one or two. So list a bunch. And in speculating, I don't know. But when I do that, I open up my mindset to what could be rather than just acting on a single track. So that's my prep. Now I go to the interpersonal part. And the interpersonal part with a difficult conversation, other than feedback, needs to always start with perspective. So I'm back to, I ask a question. I'd like to move our relationship to a better state. Can you talk to me about how you feel about our relationship? And then I need to zip and listen. And I'm not looking for the point where you say something and go, see, I told you. I am looking for completely understanding your point of view and summarizing it at the end. Well, here's what I heard from you. Now, at that point, it may be wise to just stop and say, okay, I need to think about this. And it may be possible that we can move to some action. But you have to judge that in the moment. And I often encourage people to sit on it because I think there's more gained by waiting a day than there is by rushing ahead. But after you've done the listening, now we can go to the action. And I take a page from Josh Freeman on this one, who says, list me 15 things you could do. Get a friend to help you because you will get pat to 5 and get stuck. 15. Now you're prepared to choose because the actions are almost always way down the list, not at your first 5. And then I can go back and say, in effect, okay, Will, I've thought about what you've said to me. What if we did? would this work for you? Or I can try it and see what response I get back from you.
Because you're showing you're trying to bring solutions or improvements to the table. Even if they're incorrect, you're showing that effort.
The first mover advantage is really good here when it's positive, when it's constructive, not when it's critical. Now, the things we really mess up, really badly mess up in these kind of difficult conversations is we're always giving messages with the intention of trying to make somebody else change. Now, your listeners will all say, no, I know better than that. And to which I say, bah, humbug. Buried under there is an intention to make somebody do something differently. And the moment you try to tell people what to do, you are in dangerous territory. I don't care if you're 100%, don't do it. All you can do is to say, here's the behavior, Will, and here's the impact on me, and then stop. Now, if it's your direct report, you can go on to tell them what to do, but I'm going to tell you that doesn't work very well, but you have that authority as a direct report. Nowhere else in the world do you have the authority to tell people what to do.
And if you're in that role and you're having that conversation with your manager, same thing has to apply.
Let's say I've got a manager who is not giving me enough positive feedback, the common complaint I hear. That manager may do it because they think I'm not doing a good job. They also may just be stressed for time. They also may have a personality that says, I just don't give feedback unless something's gone wrong, and nothing's gone wrong, so I'm not telling you anything. To that manager, you need to start with a statement of, I really love positive feedback and I'm at my best. I've noticed that you don't give me very much positive feedback, and the impact on me is I'm not as motivated as I would like to be. And I want you to notice the use of I and not the word you. Now the manager has a choice to make, and it's under their control any rate, whether they're going to choose. They could choose to say, oh, you're right, I don't do that. What could we do about it? Or they may say, that's just not me, I'm not going to do that, in which case you got to adjust your behavior. Or they may say, all right, let's schedule a time to talk about this because I'm better if I've had time to think about it. There's a whole host of things you could do at that point, but it has to be in your manager's hands to suggest the next step.
Let's talk about communication styles a bit. Everyone has a different style or preference of how they communicate. At Integrity Solutions, we call those behavior styles. Are those communication styles static, or can they tend to evolve over time?
So thought on this one, and neither side has won the argument so far as I can tell. Some we would say are more personality driven, like people who prefer detail are likely to always prefer detail, and they prefer to communicate with detail. Can they get better at doing something other than just the detail? Totally 100%. Are they always going to prefer detail? Probably. And another one I like to talk about is candid. I'm a very direct, candid, call it shots as they are. And occasionally that gets me in deep trouble. And sometimes it's actually quite useful. People who are not so candid in style don't always appreciate my efforts. Can I alter my style? Totally. I have to consciously think about it. Have I gotten better with the years? Yes, totally. I've gotten more comfortable with the non-candid style. But do I prefer candid all the time? What I'm trying to say is I think our preferences probably don't shift dramatically, but we learn to be more comfortable, more skilled at things that are not our preferences.
Maybe it's less about altering your style and it's more about adapting in the moment. Like you said, the example of if you're somebody that's extremely detail oriented, that's great. But if you're in a sales conversation, customer conversation with somebody who's not, can you pivot and adapt off that style for a bit based on knowing what their preference is?
It just means and the adaptations don't need to be massive. Like you would not come to that sales meeting with zero detail. Of course you would, because you would lose your confidence if you didn't have your details. You do your homework, but you start in a different place. We're looking for very small, doable things that put the other person in their comfort zone. That's where you're going to have the biggest impact.
Salespeople, we say that they need to be, quote, organizationally savvy. And by that, we mean both with customers that they're engaging with, as well as internally, navigating sort of internal organizational dynamics. What are some of the ways that salespeople can improve their abilities to become more organizationally savvy, get more done, that sort of thing?
If you can start to anticipate who's going to weigh in on a decision, what the timeline is going to look like, what their likely response is, you can get planned on your strategy in a much more effective way. And that's what I mean about organizationally savvy. It's also true that people who have high degrees of influence, either in your customer group or in your internal company, are going to carry outsized weight in persuading somebody to take an action or to not take an action. I like to look at the organization, at the organizational hierarchy. As much as we'd like to say it doesn't exist, it is still there. There's levels of budget approvals, less levels of agreeing, not agreeing, making decisions that are carried by the hierarchy. So I always start with the hierarchy. But then I start to map out where are the really strong, trusting, deep trusting relationships, because those are the people who can come to someone and say, hey, look, I know that we're considering X, Y, and Z, but let me tell you what I see and why I think that. And that will carry a lot of weight because it's a deeply trusted relationship. So I try to go through and then draw where are those trusted relationships, again, internally and externally. When you look at that map, suddenly you start to see where are your nodes of influence. And those are the places you want to make sure you are connected to, can tap, have a good relationship with.
It goes back to something you were saying before, is that it's not all about focusing on the top of the house. It's focusing on very oftentimes those junior level people who are influencers. If you engage, build rapport with them, it's going to carry you so much further.
There are some decisions that are uniquely the CEO's. So those I need to be thinking about winning the CEO over, because that's what that's going to ultimately take. But there are a lot of decisions, lots, for your salespeople, your sales listeners, that will be further, decision will be further down in the organization, because the CEO or the head of the business unit or the head of the function has delegated that decision. And the moment they get involved in it, you're stuffed. You want to look at where have they delegated it in the hierarchy? Who are they expecting? And even if they're holding the final decision, they've assigned someone to go and investigate. There's the person that's the real influencer. And that's where you want to be focused. You then want to say, who's influencing that person? So if I take my world, for example, I am often selling to the top of the house some services. It is always the HR that is going to be the gatekeeper. And they may be at the top of the organization. If they are, then it's often two and three levels below them that somebody is assigned the investigative power and the recommendations. That's the person I've got to make sure I'm connected to, because they will represent me well, particularly if they're trouble.
Because again, even if the CEO, whatever CXO level person is making the final decision, he or she is relying on the recommendations of all those other people. They're not just creating that decision in a vacuum.
If we're doing a merger and acquisition, for example, I probably have to talk to the CEO and the CFO. But those are specific kind of items that would be under the CEO's authority or the CXO's authority. You have to look down and think about who those people are and what are our connection points with those people.
And especially in sales, where this, you read everywhere, the idea that buying committees have expanded so much, the influencers and people that are involved in the process are so much greater than what might appear on the surface. And it's your responsibility to get beneath the surface and uncover those roles and again, develop those relationships with those people.
There will be a host of people, especially if it's a long-term investment, for example, that will be coming up with analysis, will have a point of view and opinion. And all of those people are people who can keep the action from going forward by just being slow, by being uncertain, by saying, oh, I think there are better options. And you want to tackle those, particularly the ones that have influence. And again, influence will always run on trust line.
And that trust aspect, again, with more junior level or one or two levels under the decision-making role, they can derail an opportunity pretty quickly. If they're conveying that they don't feel good about what's going on, they don't trust what's being said, that can be enough just there, right? To snuff something out.
They don't want to use it. Whatever it is you're selling, they don't want to use it.
Let's talk about the central theme of your book, which really relates a lot to what we talk about on this show. And it's something that salespeople and sales organizations struggle with a lot. It's that transitioning from star contributor into leadership. It's highly relevant here. It's a big issue in sales where, for various reasons, high performers will get thrust into managerial roles, and either they're not fully prepared for it, or the organization has not prepared them for it, or they just don't embrace, they haven't fundamentally understood that their role has really shifted. That can be a really particularly difficult thing for salespeople. And I think salespeople have to give a lot more consideration to, should I take this role or not? Is this where my future lies? So can you talk about what spurred you to write the book, and even like, where did the title, You Can't Know It All, come from?
Yep. So the course in modern careers in just about every function and business line I've ever looked at across the board start with proving yourself as an individual contributor in some way or another. I'm responsible for my work. I execute. I make it happen on time, on budget, with great financial results, et cetera. And that gets me promoted and rewarded. And I'm relying on myself. I'm relying on my expertise. And then occasionally we ask those people to lead, sometimes formally, sometimes informally, but they're still the expert. And this is where the team says, I'm happy to be led by you because you're more than I know. That might be your first small sales job where you've got distinct region and you've got one, two, maybe three junior salespeople working underneath you, and you fundamentally do know more than they know. And that is not the most difficult sales management job. Okay, yes, I have to learn to manage, but my interactions with that team and my value add to that team is really my content knowledge. So it's an apprenticeship model, if you really will. The real test, though, of your ability to lead and to have impact at scale comes when we give you a team where the team knows more than, and that's the big sales role that we often talk about. So in that case, you are leading sales individuals who are often older than you. They know their region, their market better than you're ever going to know it. They know their customers better than you. They may even know the products and services better than you know it. And now why? The fundamental question you have to ask is, what value am I adding to this team? And until you figure out what that value is, you're stuffed. Like nothing else is going to work. You got to figure out that value. And it's not transparent. One of the stories that I tell in the book is a guy, it's in the automotive industry. He is in the treasury department and is catapulted in to run sales in European countries. So he has 14 countries reporting to him, all of whom are senior salespeople. He's never sold a day in his life. Half of them wanted the job instead of him. So you can imagine their willingness to work with him as a leader is pretty slim. And that's an extreme case too. He had to figure out how to add value. And it turns out one of the problems for the salespeople was all the reports that they had to provide. And he says, great, I know from my treasury days how to pitch that into the finance and rest of the organization. I can do that. We can come to some rationale about what's really valuable and what's really not. And he managed to get a third, 40% of those reports eliminated. Now he's adding value. Now they're ready to work with him. Now they're willing to follow him. And the same is true for anybody stepping into that sales role as a sales manager role. You have to understand the value you are bringing, but you have to see why it's important. What people want you to do as that manager. And then that work becomes worthwhile, becomes meaningful. And it's ask that before you take the job. Talk to your sponsors and mentors. Talk to people who've made that transition and try to understand where you're going to add value, why that role is needed. That will then catapult you into a place where you can begin to spend the right amount of time on the management work and on the sales work proportionally, as well as build the relationships that are going to make the difference with the team.
Your role is to be supportive, motivational, remove obstacles, provide feedback, all of those things. Like, that's what people want from you. And do you buy into that idea of that's going to be your job day to day, week to week?
The fundamental job when you are not the expert leader is to enable the team to be fundamentally. So what is it you need to be doing to enable the team? And if you think about it as a sales leader, as a salesperson, what did you want your manager to do for you? That's the list. You do that list, that's what you're doing. And for most people who take these roles, they also end up in an odd conundrum. So there's probably some portion of their time that they are still doing sales. And some portion of their time they're supposed to be managing. So the player coach kind of conundrum that people talk about. And that is a balancing act because they're two very different sets of behaviors. And you just have to be conscious. 30% of my time is on sales. 70% of my time is on the management, or is it a different combination? And ask those questions so you know how to balance. Can I do one more story, Will?
Please, yes.
I worked with a guy, this is a lawyer, who disdained the chair of his area. What do? They just cost us a bunch of money. They go to all these meetings. Who cares? Why are they important? I don't need them, blah, 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 blah. They don't help me. So basically the manager for him. he was being pushed to take one of these managerial roles, and he was just resisting because he saw it as a waste of time. But as luck happened, he ended up in an interim management role because somebody had stepped away for an illness and suddenly started to lean into what is valuable about this role and discovered that there were priority setting, that there was a strategy to be done, that there was appropriate feedback to give, that there were people who needed more pats on the back, that there was collaboration across groups that he could facilitate. And he didn't give up his day-to-day client work completely, but he saw where he could add significant value and suddenly changed his game on whether he wanted the job and how effective he was at the job because he understood it. That's what I'd encourage salespeople to do. Look at what is really needed.
And what you said earlier is think back to what you wanted from your leaders when you're in the individual contributor role. And are you prepared and equipped to give those things now to other people? I think that's great advice.
A lot of it is first knowing what it is and then being willing, because 90% of those are learnable skills. If you just say, fine, I'm going to dig in and I'm going to get better at, you can do it.
But that's the crux, right? You have to be willing.
You will. I have to know what it is, and then I have to be willing to do it. First, I got to know what it is.
Wanda, this has been really great. Thank you so much. This is going to come out as one of our first episodes of 2024, and I think it's a great way to help people get the year started and think about ways that they can collaborate, serve customers better, communicate better, build more rapport internally and with their leaders, all those things. So this is, I think, really helpful. Thank you again.
Thanks, Will. Good questions. It's been fun talking to you.
For listeners, you can find and follow Wanda on LinkedIn, as well as on Twitter or X at Ask Wanda. Her website is leadership-forum.com. And also be sure to check out her book, You Can't Know It All, Leading in the Age of Deep Expertise. Be sure to follow us from wherever you're listening to this. Please tell a colleague or two about us. And as always, we appreciate your feedback through the ratings and reviews that you give the show. Thank you, as always, for taking time out of your day to join us. We hope you've gotten a lot out of this discussion. I'm sure you have. And be sure to catch up on any previous episodes that you might have missed. We look forward to having you join us again next time. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening, and I really hope you've enjoyed this episode of Mental Selling. Please make sure that you're subscribed, and as always, leave us a comment or a rating. Share it with your networks. You'll get more content like this on our website at integritysolutions.com. Until next time, I'm Will Milano with Integrity Solutions. Thanks very much again for being with us.